Disc 7.
Chapter 14. By the winter of 2000, as I was nearing the 2-year mark with the Mongols, I found myself spending more time at Tony's Hofbräu in East L.A. It was ironic, given the nightmarish impression I'd had the first night I'd ventured down there. How ominous the figures in black had appeared, how much courage I had to muster just to back my straight pipes to the curb. But now, Tony's Hofbräu was a kind of oasis within the Mongol nation. The situation in the San Fernando Valley was too volatile. The brawling and stabbings and drug use in the place were overwhelming me. For the most part, the guys in the SFV chapter were in their 20s and 30s, and with the constant snorting of crank and coke, they had the stamina to stay up partying and brawling all night for weeks straight. But the brothers down at Tony's Hofbräu were more laid back than the typical Mongols. There were several graybeards, guys closer to my own age, some who'd also been in the service during the Vietnam War. The L.A. brothers even listened to better music, soul gems like Marvin Gaye, The Temptations, and classic 50s doo-wop, rather than the heavy metal shit that was in constant rotation on the jukebox at the place, and that had started to feel like an incessant jackhammering inside my skull. Unlike the SFV Mongols, with these older and mellower L.A. dudes, I didn't have anyone ragging on me for not staying out all night. I throttled down on Valley Boulevard, and as I rolled up in front of Tony's Hofbräu, a half dozen Mongols from the L.A. chapter stood outside, watching me back my Harley to the curb. I shut the motor down, took my helmet off, and turned to them with a smile. "Hey, you Billy. It's a black and white world, brother." As I walked through the doors of Tony's Hofbräu, I felt like a true Mongol and not an ATF special agent. By this time, I felt more welcome in the company of these one percenters than I did among my fellow law enforcement officers. I wanted to be at Tony's on this warm night, wanted to have a beer with the LA members, and the thought of prosecuting any of them was not in my mind. I sat at the bar and ordered my usual beef sandwich and Bud. I was especially glad to see Bronson, named for his uncanny resemblance to Charles Bronson and his silent tough guy bearing. He was an older Mongol who owned and ran a paint shop in L.A. with his dad. I never saw Bronson fighting or doing drugs, but like most of us, he liked his beer. I had a couple of buds, talked with Bronson about getting a new paint job for my soft-tail Springer, and was just getting ready to head home when a new wave of Mongols showed up. Among them, I saw Mike Munns, president of the San Diego chapter. He and I greeted each other with the traditional handshake and hug. Munns was probably the most feared man in the entire Mongol nation, and for months, the San Diego Sheriff's Department had been pushing me to get close to him. The Southern California area has a good number of cops and investigators working the OMG scene full-time. We call them biker chasers. Billy Gwynn from the San Diego Sheriff's Department was the OMG expert down there, and he wanted a piece of Mike Munns bad. They were looking at Munns for the unsolved murders of two Hells Angels, but they were having a hell of a time coming up with witnesses to testify against him. Munns was a scary guy, heavily into extortion, nothing subtle, just pure fear tactics, and the Mongols had muscled their way into a number of different legitimate bars and strip clubs in the San Diego area. The San Diego Mongols were also suspected of owning an arsenal of high-powered weapons. Billy Gwynn happened to be a friend of John Chacon's, and they put in a request that I set up an operation down in San Diego. They wanted me to get next to Munns for intel-gathering purposes. Any evidence I could find about the open homicides, the extortion, the guns and drugs, which they could then roll into their own prosecution. Going down to San Diego was a risky proposition. Even hardcore Mongols were terrified of Mike Munns. He was 6'2", better than 250 pounds, rock-solid and evil-eyed. Mongols used to sit around talking about how Munns had done his prison time. Whatever joint they sent him to, he would instantly ask the inmates who was in charge of the cell block. And if anyone spoke up, Muns beat his ass to prove that he was now in charge. In addition to being intimidating, Muns suffered from bipolar disorder and needed lithium just to remain a semi-functional thug. When I first met him, we were all partying at a hotel, and I watched him popping lithium from a prescription bottle. He told me that without it, he'd be completely out of control. After our first few casual encounters, I arranged to meet Muns at a topless club called Pure Platinum near the San Diego airport. Billy Gwynn informed me that Pure Platinum was one of the clubs that the Mongols had taken over. The manager was so afraid of them that he didn't call the police, even after a San Diego prospect named Rick Slayton knocked him unconscious in front of a dozen witnesses in his own nightclub. I rolled into Pure Platinum at around 6:30 on a Wednesday evening. I saw Munz's hog sitting in the parking lot, but no other bikes were there. I threw my colors on and walked to the front door. A bouncer was waiting to collect the cover charge, but when he saw my colors, he stepped aside. "Welcome. Mike's over at the bar." Pure Platinum was more upscale than any of the topless joints I was used to going to in L.A. Bigger, cleaner, with a classier clientele. Across the room, Munz gestured for me to come on over. We did the Mongol handshake, and he introduced me to his two stripper girlfriends sitting on either side of him. Pure Platinum didn't serve food, so Munz told one of the girls to go out to get me something to eat. Munz then ordered a beer for me, and I pulled my money from my pocket. He told me to put my fucking money away. "We don't pay for nothing here." He called over to the manager, a clean-cut guy in a nice suit and tie. "This is Billy, my brother from L.A. Munz said. "Welcome to Pure Platinum." "You got a great place here," I said. "Can I get you guys a bottle of something?" I could tell the poor guy was completely intimidated, but couldn't do a thing about the constant shakedowns from Madman Munz and the San Diego crew. Now Rick Slayton walked in with his girlfriend, a menacing-looking man who rippled with muscles. He had a shaved head, an array of tattoos, and a reputation for loving fights more than he loved riding bikes. He even ended up fighting professionally on the controversial Ultimate Fighting circuit. In March 2002, during one of Slayton's no-holds-barred events at the casino of the Morongo Indian Reservation in Cabazon, California, the Mongols initiated a brawl involving 200 to 300 people when they rushed the ring after Slayton's disqualification from a fight. There were numerous injuries and one stabbing, but no prosecution was ever made, as none of the victims or witnesses were willing to cooperate. Next to arrive was Jimmy, a Mongol who'd killed a man before I began my undercover role, and had managed to convince the court-appointed psychiatrists that he was insane, so that he'd done his time in a mental institution. Everyone continued to drink on the house, and the conversation was progressing smoothly, until Munz made an impulsive suggestion that we all go down to Tijuana, Mexico, that very night. I didn't mind pushing the envelope on occasion, but a Mexico run would be out of the question. For a United States federal agent, slipping into Mexico unannounced on an undercover deal would be a career-ending mistake. Mexican authorities would go ballistic. Cross-border operations have to be cleared well in advance by both governments. Besides, I'd received intelligence that at least three Mongols in the Mexico chapter were police officers, one a federale. I made up my mind. This Mexico run wasn't going to happen, but the trouble was Mike Munz was used to everybody going along with his suggestions. As a chapter president, he outranked me, and turning him down would be a delicate business. "Come on, Billy. I know this great whorehouse got the most beautiful chicks in Mexico. For $20, you can get laid all night long." "Let's go," Jimmy said, and he even started to get up. I had to come up with something fast. "Look," I said, "I just picked up more than $30,000 worth of avionics equipment that I gotta get to Van Nuys by 7 a.m. There ain't no way I'm taking that stuff into Mexico." "You could leave it in my place," Jimmy said. "I appreciate the offer, Jimmy, but I came down here tonight just to hook up with you guys. I would love to go to Mexico and get laid, but I just can't do it. I can't risk losing my job. The next time I come down here, I'll be ready for Tijuana, okay? Munns stared at me. Suddenly intrigued by my job, he asked just what it was that I did for a living. I told him that my company bought and sold the high-tech instruments used in aircraft. He wanted to know if I could get him a job with my company. I told him I'd talk with the owner, though to read Munz's body language, it was pretty clear he viewed the word job as just another opportunity for a long-term shakedown.
"No problem, Billy," he said finally. "We'll do Mexico the next time you make it down here."
Before leaving Pure Platinum, I managed to engage Munz in a conversation about some guns that the SFV chapter had for sale. I hoped that it would bring a response about the San Diego chapter's own arsenal. I found out that all their guns were being housed at Jimmy's place. I could hardly keep from smiling when Munz said it. A murderer and an asylum alumnus had been put in charge of the munitions. When I left Pure Platinum and did the debrief with Chacon and Gwyn, I told them what I'd learned about the San Diego chapter's firearms, valuable information we needed to prepare the affidavit in order to get search warrants. But I told them I thought it was going to be nearly impossible for me to gather any intel on the homicides of those two Hells Angels, in which Munz was the prime suspect. I could feel it in my gut, the undercover instinct telling me to steer clear of this one. Mike Munz was just too violent and unpredictable a character for me to push my luck any further. I had made the big decision. The Laughlin River run in April 2000 was going to be the last significant event I would participate in as a Mongol. I'd been riding with the gang for 2 years and 2 months, and I'd taken the case further than I'd ever dreamed. I'd patched in and had been performing the duties of Secretary Treasurer of the SFV chapter, and in February, I'd been elected chapter vice president. But I had also gone well beyond my personal limit for abuse. My body was breaking down. I was constantly feeling sick, and the years of riding Harleys and hanging out in ear-splitting Mongol bars had caused permanent hearing loss. My personal life was a disaster. I'd lost touch with my own sons. My relationship with my girlfriend was over. I was isolated from my colleagues at ATF, and I knew the administrators in the LA division were wholly indifferent to the sacrifices I'd been making. As far as the investigation went, I felt like a gambler who'd been letting all his chips ride on the next roll of the dice. At some point, the law of averages was going to catch up to me. At some point, I would definitely crap out. What I feared most was making a slip, doing something stupid to give myself away. And giving myself away would no doubt cost me my life. As Laughlin approached, a new wrinkle emerged, stressing me further. We heard that the Hells Angels were spreading a rumor in the biker world that the Mongols had been infiltrated by an undercover cop. Chacon and I didn't think the rumor referred to me. It was likely just the result of some angels trying to stir up problems in the Mongols. But given the suspicion and animosity I'd long been feeling from guys like Red Dog and the Kid, and given their penchant for crank-induced paranoia, the news wasn't helping me sleep better at night. For several months, I nodded as Mongols discussed the rumor in church, repeatedly saying that they would murder the undercover if they ever found out who he was. I had come to dread the moment when I put on my helmet, fired up the Harley, and had to ride in again. I felt like a massive stone wall was about to come crashing down on me at any minute. Looking for a way to make the trip to Laughlin less onerous, I had been talking with Mongols from the Mother Chapter about riding into Laughlin with them instead of my own fuck-up of a chapter. Mother was leaving at a more reasonable hour, and I knew that it would be less of a hassle to ride with a group whose bikes wouldn't be breaking down every 20 miles. But the more I thought about the run, the less I wanted to make the trip at all. I called Chacon and told him that I just wasn't up to another 6-hour ride with the Mongols, whether it was the Mother Chapter or SFV. Chacon was frayed to the limit too, and wasn't thrilled about having to tail us. So we devised a plan that made our lives easier. we decided to put my bike in the back of a U-Haul trailer and drive it to Needles, California, a small desert community just 15 minutes from Laughlin proper. Once there, we'd offload my Softail Springer, and I'd cross the border into Nevada and on into town. I'd lay some story on the Mongols about having to stop on the way to take care of some business and needing to ride to Laughlin solo. The story wouldn't be a problem. I'd been in long enough now that I could tell them anything. The day before the run, I went to the U-Haul office in Upland and rented a truck under my Billy St. John name. I drove it home and loaded up my Harley. I noticed that the license tag on the truck was a temporary paper one out of Florida. The tag numbers had been handwritten in with a magic marker. The idea that this would be a big problem down the line never crossed my mind. I had gotten to the point of giving myself a pep talk before every meeting with the Mongols. Okay, Queen, this is the last time you're going to have to do this. Nothing's going to go wrong. It'll be a smooth operation. You can do this, brother. To my amazement, Chacon showed up precisely at 10, as we'd arranged. It was completely unlike him. Lack of punctuality was the one thing he had in common with the SFV chapter. It was great to see him instead of a bunch of Mongols. We trucked it to Needles without incident. I hunkered down low in the passenger seat to make sure that no Mongols spotted me on the road along the way. After gassing up in Needles, we found an out-of-the-way location to offload the bike. Everything went exactly as planned. I threw on my patch, along with my other Mongol regalia, and fired up the bike. The plan was for Chacon to follow me into Laughlin and break off just before I got to the Riverside Resort Hotel. We were about 5 miles out of Laughlin when everything went to shit. First, I felt my bike starting to slow down. Even though I rolled the throttle, it got slower and slower. I began to smell something burning and turned to see that my back brake was seizing up. I pulled off onto the shoulder and Chacon stopped behind me in the U-Haul. I told him that I'd have to stay put until the brake caliper cooled or until I could get a pair of pliers to bleed it off. At that very instant, a Las Vegas Metro car rolled up. Las Vegas Metro police have jurisdiction over the Laughlin municipal area. The cop asked me if I needed help, and I explained to him that my brake had just seized up and that I needed a pair of pliers. He stared at me, then at Chacon, then back at the U-Haul. Shit, I knew what was coming. Who's the guy in the U-Haul? I don't know. I've never seen him before in my life. He just saw me on the side of the road and stopped to see if I needed help. The cop wasn't biting. I tried to keep his eyes and my own on my mechanical problem. Got a pair of pliers I can use, officer? The diversionary tactic didn't work. Yes, I do, but I want to check some things out first. He backed his patrol car in behind the U-Haul and got out. I muttered under my breath to Chacon, who had gotten out of the U-Haul, "Don't tell this guy anything." Chacon nodded his silent acknowledgement. The cop walked back to my bike. "Got some ID on you?" I knew the drill. I'd been through this routine more times than I cared to remember. I broke out my undercover license and handed it over. "This your bike?" "Yeah, it's mine." "Where are you riding in from?" "L.A. Predictable cop questions, predictable Mongol answers. Then the cop asked me once again who Chacon was. I got no idea. The guy just stopped to help me. He walked over to Chacon. "Got some ID, bud?" Chacon handed over his license. The cop asked Chacon where he was coming from, and Chacon's response mirrored mine. "L.A. Pointing toward me, the cop asked Chacon if he knew me personally. "Nope. I just stopped to see if I could help him." With his clean-shaven face, neatly trimmed hair, flip-flops, and Bermuda shorts, Chacon didn't look at all like the kind of guy who would risk his neck by stopping to offer assistance to some hardcore outlaw biker on the side of the road. If I'd been in this Metro cop's boots, I wouldn't have believed this either. The cop took one look at the rinky-dink paper plate on the U-Haul, and it was game over. He picked up his radio and called for a backup unit. I looked at Chacon and whispered, "Don't tell him shit." "Where are you headed?" the cop asked me. "Laughlin." Then he looked at Chacon. "Where are you headed?" Laughlin. Clearly, Chacon hadn't heard my answer over the traffic, or just didn't expect the cop to keep harassing us.
What's in the back of the truck?
Nothing, Chacon responded. We're sitting in the middle of the desert just outside Laughlin, where 30,000 bikers of all types are congregating. I'm plainly a one percenter in the company of Mr. Clean Jeans, who happens to be driving a very suspicious U-Haul truck, trying to sell this cop a bag of rotten goods he can smell a mile away. Chacon had his ATF identification on him, but we had no idea if we could trust these Las Vegas Metro cops with the truth. The Mongols spend a lot of time partying in Laughlin and Vegas, and it wouldn't have surprised me to learn that they had developed informants with access to confidential police information. The Metro cop turned his attention back to me.
What's in the back of the truck?
How should I know? I told you I never seen this guy in my life. I tried to sound like an illiterate punk. The cop looked like he'd heard this line 1,000 times before and made no effort to hide his disdain. His backup unit arrived with lights flashing. The cop now told Chacon and me to assume the position. We placed our hands against the side of the U-Haul, over our heads, legs spread wide. They began to frisk us for weapons. Both cops went after Chacon this time.
Sir, where'd you rent this truck?
In L.A.
Let's see the registration and rental papers.
This was a demand, not a request. I could see the cop walking to the cab of the truck. We waited with our hands still overhead. The minute I said I didn't know Chacon, I knew I'd bet the wrong horse. I was probably too exhausted to think clearly. Why hadn't I simply claimed Chacon was my brother-in-law, helping me move? It's just the nature of undercover work. You're thinking on your feet 24/7, and sometimes you improvise wrong. The cop, rental agreement in hand, returned to the side of the truck where I was still in the assumed position. He unfolded the agreement, took maybe 5 seconds to look it over, and discovered that everything he'd heard in the last 10 minutes was just so much fabricated bullshit. Raising his eyes from the rental agreement, he glared at me.
So, you've never seen this guy in your life, huh?
I was off balance, with one foot on the ground and the other in my mouth. I responded like a true Mongol.
No comment.
The two cops decided that the situation demanded a little more backup. One cop got on his radio, while the other decided to take a closer look in the truck. There were no warrants out for Billy St. John's arrest, and the truck wasn't stolen. So what if I'd been the one who rented the truck, and we'd lied to the cops? There was still no justification for an arrest. People lie to cops every day, and cops know it. I figured they'd badger us for a while and then let us go. Standard police procedure. Then I saw the cop who had been looking in the truck jog back to where we were all standing. He grabbed Chacon and threw him forcefully against the truck. He had him handcuffed in seconds. What had my little straight-arrow case agent done to deserve such rough treatment?
Ooh, you must have really fucked up, I said under my breath.
No sooner had I made my cheap shot comment than the other cop grabbed me and snapped the cuffs on me. Just then I saw John Carr and Darren Kozlowski cruising past on Interstate 40, just in time to catch a glimpse of us being cuffed and thrown up against the U-Haul. Seconds later, we heard a huge roar, and I saw a large group of Mongols on Harleys cruising past and staring at me. Things were going from bad to worse with each passing minute. I'd considered all kinds of things that might go wrong on this last big run with the Mongols, but getting arrested with Chacon in the desert wasn't one of them. I saw one of the cops go back to the cab of the truck and return with Chacon's gun in his hand.
Did you know he had a gun? The cop asked me.
No way, man. Like he was going to believe anything I had to say at this point. The cops were doing everything by the book now. No chances, no mistakes. They demanded to know what was in the back of the truck. When more backup arrived, they opened the U-Haul to find nothing except the elastic tie-downs we'd used to hold my bike. I saw Chacon motion to one of the cops, a sergeant, saying that he wanted to talk with him around the back of the truck. The sergeant and another cop led Chacon off. After about 10 minutes, they all returned to where I was standing cuffed.
The sergeant made a kind of public statement, as if he was trying to get it on record for his guys as well as for me. He said that there was no evidence that the gun was unlicensed, and since it had been found in a closed briefcase, they wouldn't be able to charge anyone with its possession. He also said that everything else looked in order and that they would be letting both Chacon and me go on our way. Free and clear. After taking our pictures and filling out field interrogation cards, standard operating procedure for dealing with known gang members, and my Mongol colors identified me as a real gangster, the cop who'd originally stopped us finally gave me a pair of pliers so I could bleed off the back brake on my bike. We drove off separately. I was worried about what the passing Mongols might have seen, but it wasn't worth risking another stop to call Chacon. I had to hurry into Laughlin, show my face at the hotel, and try to pick up my role as Mongol Billy as soon as possible. It wasn't until hours later, when I managed to place an inconspicuous call to Chacon, that I learned what had really happened behind that U-Haul. Not relishing the prospect of a few hours in the Huskow, Chacon had decided to admit to being an ATF agent while at the same time preserving my UC identity. He told them that he was working undercover on the Mongols and that I was a full-patch member of the club. As a hangaround, he'd been told to drive the truck and follow me to Laughlin, then get lost. Taking into account his straight appearance and my outlaw appearance, I knew the cops had to be dubious. But Chacon had federal credentials, and when they ran a check on his license, it verified that he was a U.S. Treasury Department agent. For these cops to buy the line of crap Chacon was selling, they would have had to conclude that Chacon was one of the dumbest people they had ever run into. If you're an undercover agent, then why the hell are you carrying your ATF credentials? One of the cops asked. Chacon explained that the Mongols had told him to follow me out, drop off the truck, and beat it. He didn't think he'd be hanging out with them. These Las Vegas Metro cops weren't going to risk fucking up a federal investigation, no matter how stupid the undercover agent might be, and risk whatever consequences that might bring down on them from their bosses. I finally rolled into Laughlin and met up with a group of Mongols standing in the parking lot of the Riverside Hotel. Word had reached them that the Metro cops had Billy St. John hooked up about 5 miles outside Laughlin. I knew I'd have to come up with yet another story about what had happened on the side of the road, in particular, why I didn't end up behind bars like a good little outlaw. I had my slightly resembling the truth alibi concocted for them. Yeah, I can't fucking believe it. My back brake locked up on me, and a couple of dudes in a U-Haul stopped to help. The cops swooped in and were honest like stink on shit. Turns out, one of the dudes in the U-Haul was wanted for murder up north somewhere. Man, I thought I was going to the Gray Bar Hotel for sure. They had me hooked for about an hour before they finally let my ass go. Shit, I'm just glad I'm here. Brother, you fucking lucked out.
Yeah, I did.
I walked into the Riverside with the Mongols I'd met out front, and we joined about 20 more of our comrades in arms just inside the front doors. But my luck was about to change. It wasn't going to be a laid-back Laughlin run after all. The Mongols were going into combat mode. There was going to be a showdown with the Hells Angels here in Laughlin. The state of war between the Hells Angels and the Mongols had never been declared over, and tension between the clubs had been building in the 2+ years I'd been undercover. One night, Domingo and I went down to Chatsworth and partied with a group of Angels at the Cowboy Palace. It had been a cool night, Angels buying beer for Mongols, Mongols buying beer for Angels. But the situation east of L.A. in San Bernardino County quickly ended any such fraternization. The original chapter of the Hells Angels Motorcycle Club was founded in Fontana, within San Bernardino County, as an offshoot of an older outlaw group known as the Pissed Off Bastards of Bloomington. Consequently, the Angels considered San Bernardino, or Burdu, hallowed ground. The Mongols, having won the right to wear the coveted California lower rocker, agreed not to form a chapter in Burdu. The agreement had been honored for decades, but in 1999,
a problem arose over a technicality. The agreement stated only that there would be no Mongol chapters established in Burdu, but it didn't say that there would be no Mongols living in Burdu. And a good number of Mongols did live in Burdu. Mongols frequented the bars in the area and rode the streets, flying their black and white patches with impunity. In time, it started to rub the Burdu chapter of the Hell's Angels raw. The Angels began putting out the word that they were getting fed up with the Mongols invading Burdu, and that they were going to start throwing Mongols out of the bars and shooting them off their bikes if they didn't leave San Bernardino County. During church at Evil's place one Thursday night, Domingo announced that the word had come down from Little Dave. Enough was enough. It was time to put the Angels in their fucking place. It was time to show them who really ran the show in Southern California. Little Dave had decided that we were going to go down and make our presence known at the crossroads, the most popular Hell's Angels watering hole in San Bernardino County. We rode out to Burdu in a Mongol raiding party, at least 100 strong. We only stayed inside the crossroads for a couple of hours, just long enough to make a point. The Angels weren't going to be kicking any Mongols out of Burdu anytime soon. Massing in the lobby of the Riverside, the brothers from Mother now gave me the lowdown on what had happened in Laughlin, while Chacon and I were getting the third degree on the highway. Before I'd arrived, the Mongols had already had a run-in with the Hell's Angels inside the casino of the Flamingo. All the months of tension, posturing, and bad blood were coming to a head. Mongols were milling around in the lobby and casino areas, waiting for the word on how to deal with the red and white. The orders had already come down for a number of Mongols to ride 66, armed but not wearing their colors. This signified seriously bad news. The Mongols are never more dangerous than when massing at a rally like Laughlin, with a cadre of armed undercovers ready to kill for the club at a moment's notice. I wondered if Chacon and the boys had gotten the word too. Standard protocol at the Laughlin River Run was for the Mongols to occupy the Riverside Resort Hotel and the Hell's Angels to occupy the Flamingo Hilton. It was about 9 p.m. when Little Dave and Bobby Loco rallied the troops in front of the Riverside. Bobby Loco addressed the group of Mongols that was now 30 strong and said that there had been a confrontation with the Angels earlier in the day. The plan was for all of us to go to the Flamingo and confront the Hell's Angels in the casino to see what they were made of. There was no way I was going to be able to contact Chacon to let him know about the impending confrontation. I just hoped he and my backups were out there watching closely. After Bobby Loco's announcement, we immediately left for the Flamingo. We were being led by Mike Munns, who everyone, Angels, Bandidos, and any other outlaw gangsters, knew to be a human hurricane. Earlier in the evening, in fact, Munns had bumped into a girl, one of the Angels' groupies, in the men's room at the Flamingo, and knocked her unconscious. Munns made no distinction between a 300-pound male adversary or a 90-pound female, especially if she was stumbling into the wrong bathroom and a loudmouth to boot. Even when unarmed, Munns wouldn't hesitate to wade headlong into a gun and knife fight, or, in this case, into a group of 500 Hell's Angels. With the precision of an army platoon, we rolled into the Flamingo Hotel, right through hundreds of the red and white. All around us were those brothers riding 66, a dozen dressed-down Mongols who I knew were all armed to the teeth with clear instructions to take care of business if the shit hit the fan. The Mongol nation was stone-faced as we moved through the Flamingo, more than ready to go to war over the day's disrespect. I think the red and white knew it. The Angel crowd parted wide when the army of black and white came through. The Mongols strolled around the casino until they found an area in which to circle like a wagon train, preparing to stave off an Indian attack. In a defensive maneuver reminiscent of my tour in Vietnam, we stood facing outward, arms crossed, staring out at the crowd from behind dark glasses. There was no doubting the Mongols' mood tonight. We were substantially outnumbered, And if it went bad, we might get slaughtered. I looked around for Cletus and Paul, the two deputies from the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, who looked and dressed like bikers and were able to mingle freely among the thousands of bikers in Laughlin. I knew that if the bullets started flying in the Flamingo, my only way out alive might be with them. But where the hell were they? Behind my black shades, I scanned the crowd. I noticed various groups of angels growing visibly agitated at the Mongo presence. I returned the angry glare of several angels, what we call the mad dog, an outright invitation to confrontation among one percenters. While glancing around the casino, I finally spotted Cletus. He didn't have full patch status, but he fit right in with any biker crowd. He was able to go places, clean-cut John Chacon, especially in his Bermuda shorts and flip-flops, could only dream of. Cletus towered over me at a beefy and muscular 6'4". A gregarious guy with a bellowing laugh. He had a beard longer than mine and wore attire just as offensive to the mainstream as my own. His partner, Paul, tended to stay in Cletus's shadow, but could more than hold his own in any rough situation. Despite being a cop, Cletus was something of a Hell's Angels aficionado, and, truth be told, probably bought into the red and white hype just a bit. It wasn't that uncommon, even among biker experts, to believe that the Angels were still the gold standard they'd been back in the 1960s. Prominent Hell's Angels like Ralph Sonny Barger, longtime Oakland chapter president and considered the founding father, and Chuck Zito, the former New York chapter president, helped perpetuate the Angels' mystique, keeping the allure of the so-called Big Red Machine in the media spotlight. We continued mad-dogging the Angels, and in less than 5 minutes, the club's upper echelon showed up for a powwow. Even violent criminals are occasionally willing to try a little diplomacy. Little Dave, Bobby Loco, and Mike Munns talked with the Angels' representatives for a few minutes. The Angels assured the Mongols that there would be no further shows of disrespect and apologized for any shown earlier. I was amazed at this act of contrition on the part of the Angels. Cletus's black leather-clad arms were folded across his chest, and his head was shaking in disbelief. He looked at me without saying a word or making a sign, but his eyes spoke volumes. I knew his esteemed Angels had sorely disappointed him. As we left the Flamingo, various Angels snarled at us under their breath. None dared to make a move on us, though. I read the faces of various Angels' prospects, hangarounds, and groupies as we rolled out. The followers of what was reputed to be the premier outlaw motorcycle gang in the world were perplexed by what they'd just seen. It was a black-and-white world now. A distinct feeling came over me as I strutted through the Flamingo. I couldn't help myself. I was proud. Proud of my brothers, proud of myself. I had just stood shoulder to shoulder with the Mongols against the notorious Hell's Angels. We had bat them down. Right in their own yard, in front of God and every other eyewitness. Without even needing to get physical, we'd given the Angels a lesson in respect. Having played my part, I marched in lockstep with my Mongol brothers through the flashing lights of the Flamingo Casino. Now it was time for Billy St. John to go home for good. Chapter 15. 42 arrested in motorcycle gang raids, by Mitchell Landsberg, Los Angeles Times. Hundreds of federal agents and Los Angeles County Sheriff's deputies fanned out over three states Friday to drop an investigation net over the Mongols Motorcycle Club, arresting at least 42 people in Southern California and seizing dozens of illegal guns, cocaine, and stolen motorcycles, they said. The crackdown was the culmination of a perilous 2.5-year investigation in which an undercover federal agent joined the club and rose into its executive ranks, an official of the U.S. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms said. Authorities described the Mongols as among the most violent of outlaw motorcycle gangs and said its members were suspected in a wide variety of crimes that included murder, extortion, arson, weapons violations, and illegal drug dealing.
The undercover ATF agent, who was not identified, joined the Mongols' San Fernando Valley branch and rose through the ranks to become club treasurer. Before joining, the agent was subjected to a background check by a private investigator working for the Mongols. How a veteran federal agent managed to pass that check and remain undetected for 2 years in a reputedly ruthless motorcycle gang was among the tantalizing questions left unanswered by the federal officials, who declined to discuss the operation in any detail. Our undercover agent put himself at great and prolonged peril to develop evidence of murder, weapons and narcotics violations, and other serious crimes, Donald Kincaid, the Los Angeles Division Director of the ATF, said in a written statement. He said the crackdown had shaken the gang to its core.
It was a harrowing final month between the last run to Laughlin in April and preparations for the end of my undercover role. Leaving the role meant vanishing at the last possible moment. Adding to my stress level in the weeks before I was to disappear, I had to hang out daily with the gang, while at the same time, Chacon was taking the investigation before a federal grand jury. For hours each day, he was laying out the details of our undercover operation for 17 civilians. We had no idea who some of these men and women might have connections to. 17 people who were not in law enforcement now knew of the investigation and could tell their friends and family about a federal undercover agent infiltrating the Mongols. It took several weeks to complete the operation plan for the final raids. I spent my remaining time with the gang gathering intelligence for Chacon and the U.S. Attorney's Office for search warrants. I would feed them information about known weapons and narcotics locations for them to write up in the warrants. On the day of the takedown, May 19th, 2000, I vanished forever from my role as Billy St. John. I was relocated to a safe house in downtown Los Angeles. Weeks earlier, my ex-wife and my sons had been moved far from Los Angeles for their safety. Until the investigation was almost over, we'd had no idea they were going to have to move. Although we protested the distant destination chosen by ATF, it was to no avail. We were all very upset. 1 week in advance, ATF personnel from Bureau headquarters in Washington and from around the United States began to converge on Los Angeles. Every ATF special response team from around the country was ordered to participate in the operation. More than 300 ATF agents and 375 Los Angeles County Sheriff's deputies and detectives raided scores of locations, mostly in Southern California, but also as far away as Oklahoma, Colorado, and Georgia. The raids netted some 70 illegal firearms, including handguns, machine guns, and assault rifles, as well as explosives. 17 stolen motorcycles, 2 kilograms of cocaine, significant quantities of marijuana and methamphetamine, and tens of thousands of dollars in cash. It also led to 54 indictments, which in turn yielded 53 convictions. Raids on some of the Mongols' homes turned up frighteningly powerful arsenals. At the residence of Lonnie Slick Gallegos, Secretary Treasurer of the El Sereno Chapter, Los Angeles County Sheriff's officers and ATF agents found the following: a Beretta shotgun, a Mossberg 12-gauge shotgun, a Glenfield 22 semi-automatic rifle, a Maverick 12-gauge shotgun, a Norinco 84S assault weapon, a Norinco Mach 90 assault rifle, an Intratec 9mm assault weapon, a Smith & Wesson 9mm pistol, a Jennings 22 semi-automatic pistol, a Charter Arms 44 special revolver, a 357 Magnum blue steel revolver, a bulletproof vest, 9 plastic bags of marijuana, military and firearms training manuals, $1,400 in cash, and a set of brass knuckles. Though much of the contraband was in plain view, Gallegos's Mongol colors, his most prized possession, were found locked inside a sentry safe in the garage. Throughout the raids, representatives from the United States Attorney's Office, U.S. Customs Service, U.S. Marshals Service, U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service, the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms manned a crisis center in downtown L.A. The crisis center was a buzzing hive of law enforcement activity. In these cases, no matter how carefully the logistics have been laid out, the facts on the ground invariably change throughout the raids. Some of the gang members can't be easily identified. Some lie about their given names and don't have legitimate identification on their persons. I was constantly on the phone helping other agents ID suspects. There were also numerous instances when we had to get rollback warrants. In these instances, agents and deputies executing search warrants at dozens of residences and places of business would discover that a location not covered by the original warrant, for example, a detached garage, was actually suspected of housing a stash of firearms or drugs. They would call us at the crisis center, and we'd handle the paperwork of getting a judge to issue a rollback warrant so that we could legally complete the search. For safety reasons, I could never return to my undercover apartment, and the place was shut down by other ATF agents. I was housed in a downtown Los Angeles hotel and had a special response team assigned to me around the clock for protection. The day of the raids, I reported to the crisis center at 4 in the morning and began working the phones. It was a surreal feeling. The undercover role was over for me. But what did the future hold? I knew I would be called upon to testify against numerous Mongols and their associates, perhaps for years to come. As I walked around the buzzing crisis center, law enforcement officers I didn't know kept pointing at me. It made me feel like some kind of sideshow attraction. Other officers were slapping my shoulder, shaking my hand, congratulating me. After a few hours, I felt numb and deeply conflicted as I monitored the progress of the raids. I worried about the safety of the agents and officers going into those 70 locations, Mongol residences, clubhouses, and places of business. Hardcore gangsters would be going to jail today, but for years, I've been calling these gangsters my brothers. I was both proud of my work as an undercover agent and sad about the ramifications my work would have for some of the men I'd grown close to. The case was among the most ambitious and logistically complex undercover operations ever undertaken against an outlaw biker organization. In the following months, ATF made 13 more arrests, and I began the grueling task of preparing to testify against many of my former Mongol brothers in various federal and state trials. Supplementing my eyewitness testimony were hundreds of hours of tape recordings I'd made in my wired Mustang, in my undercover apartment, and using covert ATF digital recorders secreted on my person. I'd gathered evidence of major drug dealing, motorcycle theft, extortion, assault, and rape. I'd helped solve the November 1999 homicide of Daniel Herrera. Of the 54 people we indicted in the operation, 53 were convicted. Most of them opted for guilty pleas when they saw the overwhelming evidence against them. The lone acquittal was the result of one Mongol, Rancid, taking full credit for a firearms violation and exonerating his brother outlaw on the witness stand. The day after the takedown, I was on my way out of Los Angeles with my special response team escort when I received a call on my cell phone. It was Top Hat, a Mongol who lived just outside Daytona Beach, Florida. Top Hat had a legitimate job driving a truck long distance, and throughout the years of the investigation, he'd often been out in California. I first met him at Domingo's house during a get-together, and we hit it off immediately. He was an older biker, around my age, and we used to sit around and shoot the shit. During one of these conversations, I learned that prior to patching in with the Mongols, Top Hat had ridden with the Warlocks Motorcycle Club when my ATF buddy Steve Martin went undercover with them. Top Hat rattled off the names of one percenters who ended up going to prison because of Martin's undercover work. "No shit, Top," I said. "Boy, you just never know." In the frenzy of the previous day's raids, no one in the club was exactly sure what had happened. Had the Mongol leadership been infiltrated by a federal agent or a cop? Had one of the patches been cooperating? had the gang simply been targeted in a conventional surveillance and wiretap case. From the back seat of the SRT's Chevrolet Suburban, I gestured for all the other agents to keep silent. Top Hat had just gotten word of the California raids and wanted to make sure I was okay. Yeah, Top, I'm okay. Can you believe this shit? I've been through this before, Billy. I can't believe it's happening again. He got quiet for a second, then said, Look, we know who rolled on us. I prepared for him to unload on me, but what he said next threw me completely off guard. It's that big fat fucker in the South Bay chapter. I knew who he was referring to, a new patch we called Preacher. I knew that many of the Mongols had never trusted Preacher, partly because he had patched over from another outlaw club, partly because his attitude was far too laid back for most of the boys. But Preacher was going to be dealt with very shortly, Top had assured me. The Mongols had dispatched four guys to his home to kill him today. They're on their way now, he said. They sure it's him, Top? 'Cause I don't think so. Yeah, Billy, they know it's him. That fucker's gonna be dead in short order. I made the kind of snap decision that had become second nature to me during my years of undercover life. I was going to tell Top Hat who I really was, let the entire Mongol nation know the truth about Billy St. John. I had no other choice. As a law enforcement officer, my first sworn duty was to protect an innocent life. And if the hit team was already in motion, then it was only about an hour before they'd be at Preacher's place. There was no way I could stall and bullshit Top Hat, dilly-dally with excuses, try to get Chacon on the phone, and put together an ATF operation to stop the murder. The only guy who could save Preacher now was Billy St. John. I took a deep breath and glanced out the tinted window of the SUV as the freeway flew past. Top, that South Bay Mongol didn't roll, I said. Yeah, he did, Billy. Now it's just a matter of taking him out. Listen to me carefully, Top. He didn't roll. You know how I know he didn't roll? 'Cause it was me, Top Hat. I'm an agent for ATF. You hear me? So you need to call whoever's in charge of that murder detail and tell them the truth. Billy St. John rolled. If they kill that dude, they'll be killing the wrong guy. And I'll make sure they spend a long fucking time in prison for it. Top Hat didn't say another word. I heard his breathing for a few seconds. Then he hung up. I called Chacon to tell him that the Mongols now knew the truth about me. He immediately dispatched ATF agents to make certain the Preacher wasn't harmed. As we drove out of Los Angeles, I didn't know just how to feel. My world seemed to be crashing down on me. My testimony against the Mongols stretched on for two more years, through more than two dozen hearings and trials in different jurisdictions. Long before my first court appearance, I was permanently relocated to a safe house in Plano, Texas. As I was driven to my new temporary home by a special response team, the reality hit me. I was leaving my whole life behind. My ex-wife and my sons had been moved to Florida, set up under new legal names. It was now going to be nearly impossible for me to spend any regular time with my children. The night times in Texas were the worst. I missed my kids, missed Southern California, missed my friends. I had thousands of hours of undercover taped conversations to be transcribed, and although I was assigned to the Dallas Field Division, I had little to no contact with them. The only people I saw on occasion were members of the Dallas ATF SRT charged with my security. The first time I flew back to L.A. to testify was in the prosecution of Junior, who'd been the national president of the Mongols before Little Dave. When I had left California, I was still in Billy St. John mode, with my stringy hair hanging down my back, my beard long and straggly and turning white. Everyone in ATF had gotten used to that version of me. When I landed at LAX for Junior's trial, I was clean cut, clean shaven, and looked like any other cop. I could see Special Agent John Jakes in the company of several heavily armed Special Response Team agents. waiting to meet me as I got off the plane. Jakes and I had gone through several ATF medic schools together and even administered IVs to each other in training. I waved to him, but he just stared past me.
"Hey," I yelled, "are you guys looking for me, or are you here to pick up somebody else?"
Jakes let out a huge laugh when he finally recognized me.
"Jesus," he said, "I was looking for Billy the Biker."
I shook hands with Jakes and the members of my protection detail, and they hustled me out of LAX to a clandestine hotel in the Covina area. I had worked on a lot of ATF protection details throughout my career, guarding the President of the United States and various dignitaries from around the world. I knew the procedures, but it was odd to be the one protected. I knew there was good reason for the protection. If the Mongols could get away with it, I knew they would try to kill me. I'd heard them talk about it in church. I'd heard proven murderers talking matter-of-factly about cop killing. I remember the night when Domingo had told me that he'd like to go out in a blaze of glory, killing a bunch of cops. He'd go down in Mongol legend as a great hero, the biggest murderer in a club filled with murderers. I thought about the gang members who had military backgrounds and the possibility of a sniper shot outside the courthouse. I tried to calm myself down as we rode to the courthouse in the San Fernando Valley. I had ATF agents in front of me and behind me, deputies from the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, charged with security at all Los Angeles courthouses, had a massive presence there that day. If the Mongols wanted to take a shot at me, they would have their work cut out for them. We pulled into the back of the courthouse near a loading dock. ATF agents checked and double-checked the area for suspicious vehicles and people. Several deputies waited at the back door as I was escorted up the loading ramp. The hallways were carefully cleared and secured as I entered them. I was quickly rushed to a secure room where I waited to be escorted by agents into the courtroom. Early on in my undercover role, Junior had been convicted of assault with a deadly weapon and sentenced to 16 years in state prison. But his attorneys managed to get his conviction overturned on a technicality and win him a new trial. I was being called as an expert witness to demonstrate that the Mongols had been engaged in the crime of witness tampering. I had been privy to a number of conversations with Domingo and Red Dog that involved the gangs intimidating the witnesses scheduled to testify against Junior, as well as trying to find other witnesses willing to falsely testify on his behalf. The psychological ordeal of looking a Mongol in the eye for the first time since I emerged from the undercover role was tempered by the fact that I hardly knew Junior. I had only met him once during my first Laughlin River run with the gang, so there weren't many personal feelings between us. Junior was a very violent man and a lifelong criminal, and I knew that he needed to be in prison. Mongols who wanted to be in the courtroom while I gave my testimony were being strip-searched. There were several in attendance, but the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department was taking no chances, and they weren't going to let any intimidation tactics by Mongols go unchallenged. Over the years, testifying against my former Mongol brothers became a kind of personal purgatory. I came to dread those court dates almost as much as I dreaded my time as a Mongol prospect. Red Dog, much to my relief, pleaded guilty to a federal firearms violation and was sentenced to 3 years in prison without my having to give eyewitness testimony against him in open court. I hated the anticipation of making eye contact with the Mongols I had come to know well in my years undercover. My mind would play tricks on me as I sat in my Texas house playing with Winchester, my golden retriever, and reviewing my tape transcripts before each court date. I was their friend. I was their brother. I drank with them. I partied with them. I rode with them and fought for them. I knew their kids' names, and they told me they loved me. Jesus, I had no doubt that guys like Domingo, Rocky, and Evo would have died for me. I knew that going eyeball to eyeball with Evo in court was going to be painful. Domingo had pled guilty, so I never had to testify against him. In February 2001, I was subpoenaed to testify against Evil. Once again, On a bright Monday morning, I found myself staring anxiously out the window of a Boeing 777 on my way to Los Angeles. My protection detail was there to meet me, and the trip from LAX to a hideout hotel went smoothly. I had a few days in which to sit down with the prosecuting attorney, whittling out a strategy. It was no big deal, as far as trials go, except that I really did not want to see Evo get hammered again. He had already taken a couple of hits, convicted in separate assault and theft cases, and now he was looking at spending more years in the penitentiary. He was on trial for his role in the Mongol's stolen motorcycle ring, but I just didn't see the benefit of adding another dozen years to Evil's prison time. But it wasn't my call to make. I was just a small cog in a much larger machine. Besides, I said to myself, Evil had no one to blame but himself. I kept telling myself that I was on the right side here, that I was doing what needed to be done. But I'd been in the law enforcement business for a long time, and I'd seen the outrageous occur in court. I'd seen the most vicious criminals, murderers, who should be doing life in prison, walk away, scot-free. I had to tell myself over and over that it wasn't me that Evil loved. It wasn't me that Evil would have given his life for. Evil loved my persona. He loved the shadow I created in his mind. Billy St. John, the hardcore Mongol outlaw. Evil wouldn't have hesitated to kill Special Agent William Queen. Wednesday rolled around, and I found myself sitting outside the courtroom in that horrible limbo, waiting to testify, to face Evil. Chacon was already inside the courtroom, sitting next to the assistant United States attorney. I was trying to calm my nerves by making small talk with Zach from the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, who was a friend as well as a member of my protection detail. I kept drifting back and forth between the present and the past. I could see myself laughing and drinking beer with Evil up in my undercover apartment as we broke down that stolen Softail Springer. I could see myself doing better than 130 miles per hour on the 210 freeway as Evil blew past me with plenty of throttle to spare. Then I remembered the awful scene in his house when he'd split his wife's face wide open, and I'd done my damnedest to stitch her back up. God, I wished I could be a regular cop like Zach. It was all black and white to him. There were no personal issues. It was simply a matter of right or wrong. But things weren't so clear-cut to me. The cop in me knew that the Mongols were serious bad guys who needed to be prosecuted and put away. But there was another factor that cops like Zach and Chacon could never understand. I'd not only witnessed it and lived it, I had felt it. When my mom died, and no one from ATF had so much as offered their condolences, but the whole of the Mongol nation embraced me. And guys like Evil had hugged me and told me, I love you, Billy. I felt and understood the bond holding together these outlaw motorcycle gangs. We could take down their gun trafficking networks, bust their drug dealing operations, prosecute them for extortion and armed robbery and rape and homicide. The thing we could never attack was the love these guys felt for their brothers. In many cases, it was a love stronger than for their blood relations. It was stronger than the most addictive narcotic. The door swung open suddenly. It was Chacon, and his expression was resolute. Billy, you're up, he said. I walked into the courtroom and caught a quick glimpse of Evil as I made my way to the witness stand, stopping short to be sworn in by the clerk. Do you solemnly swear that the testimony you are about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God? The whole truth, I thought. The court was in no way interested in hearing the whole truth. I do, I said, then took the witness stand. At first, I tried not to look at Evil, but it was like some invisible force, some gravitational pull, wrenching my eyes toward him. I glanced over to see him staring right at me. He wasn't mad-dogging me. He wasn't giving me that Mongol murder glare like we'd given the angels in Laughlin. If anything, Evil's eyes looked hurt and plaintive.
Billy, what the hell are you doing? Can't you see it's me? It's Evil.
Just then I heard the judge's voice echoing in the hollow-sounding courtroom. Would you state your full name for the court and spell the last name, please? It took me a moment to regain my composure. Yes, Your Honor, it's William Queen, Q-U-E-E-N, special agent with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. Epilogue. Our undercover investigation was a massive blow to the Mongols' motorcycle club, but the gang was by no means decimated. Exactly 2 years after my last day with them, a large convoy of Mongols rolled into Laughlin, Nevada for an annual show of strength at River Run 2002. And just as I'd seen in the Flamingo Casino, the Mongols went prepared for anything the Hells Angels might try. This time, the showdown went beyond posturing. On April 27, 2002, just after 2 a.m., a group of about 35 Hells Angels left the Flamingo Hotel and cruised on their Harleys to nearby Harrah's Casino to back 50 Angels who were already there. On the casino floor, they squared off against about 40 Mongols. An Angel delivered a karate kick to the chest of a Mongol. Then all hell broke loose, with fists flying and a blur of wrenches and hammers and knives. In the melee, one Mongol pulled a semi-automatic and shot an Angel point-blank in the belly. When the battle was over, three bikers lay dead, two Angels and one Mongol. Dozens of innocent bystanders had been hurt in the rioting. A third Angel was later found shot to death on a highway in San Bernardino County. He had been on his way home from the Laughlin Run. The Mongol who was stabbed to death inside Harrah's was my friend Bronson, the mellow older brother from the L.A. chapter who had helped me paint my soft-tail Springer. I'd imagined many of the Mongols I knew dying in battle with the Hells Angels, but Bronson wasn't one of them. I was very sorry it had to be him. But it's the nature of the one-percenter world. Motorcycle gangs like the Mongols, for all the terror and violence they inspire in law-abiding citizens, wreak their most complete devastation on their own. Prison, drug addiction, or violent death is the expected end for any man willing to wear that black and white patch. Mongols Motorcycle Club Defendants Court Proceedings. Defendants who pled guilty. 1. Afanesco, James, Jimmy. Pled guilty to a violation of the federal firearms laws, sentenced to federal prison. 2. Alarcon, Philip, Evil. Pled guilty to interstate transfer of stolen motorcycles, RICO Predicate Act, sentenced to federal prison. 3. McDonald, Jeremy, J.R. Pled guilty to interstate transfer of stolen motorcycles, RICO Predicate Act, sentenced to federal prison. 4. Chavez, Raymond, Ray Ray. Pled guilty to a violation of the federal firearms laws and violations of the federal narcotics laws, sentenced to federal prison. 5. Jarvis, Donald, Red Dog. Pled guilty to a violation of the federal firearms laws, sentenced to federal prison. 6. Luna, Thomas, Tommy T. Pled guilty to a violation of the federal narcotics laws, sentenced to federal prison. 7. Barrera, Corena. Pled guilty to a violation of the federal narcotics laws, sentenced to federal prison. 8. Boyson, Bruce. Pled guilty to unauthorized use of a law enforcement computer. Boyson was a dispatcher for the California Highway Patrol who accessed law enforcement computers on behalf of the Mongols. Boyson was fired from the CHP, received a felony conviction, and served a short jail term. After serving the term, Boyson was placed on probation for 3 years. 9. Vega, Johnny, Cowboy. pled guilty to a violation of the federal firearms laws, sentenced to federal prison. Murder cases. 1. Gutierrez, Adrian, Panhead. Gutierrez was tried in Superior Court of Los Angeles and found guilty of murder with a gang allegation enhancement and sentenced to state prison. 2. Hannah, David. Murder charges are still under investigation. Machine gun cases. The following five defendants pled guilty in the Central Judicial District of California to trafficking in machine guns and were sentenced to federal prison. 1. Alvarez, Timothy, Domingo. 2. Garcia, Robert, Bobby Loco. 3. Jimenez, Ernest, AK. 4. Lujan, Michael, Mansion Mike. 5. Vogel, Richard, Shaggy. The following two defendants pled guilty in the Central Judicial District of California to possession of a machine gun and were sentenced to federal prison. 1. Jimenez, Ernest, AK. 2. Vega, Johnny, Cowboy. Firearms cases. With one exception, all of the following defendants were convicted in the U.S. District Court or Los Angeles County Superior Court of various firearms-related charges and were sentenced to federal or state prison. 1. Castillo, Christopher, Recon. 2. Clayton, Richard, Rancid. 3. Kramer, Douglas, Buckethead. 4. Gallegos, Lonnie, Slick. 5. Gonzalez, Joe, Lil Joe. 6. Guevara, Martin, Largo. 7. Howard, Joseph, The Kid. 8. Valles, Leonard, Lenny. 9. Cardenas, Manuel, Woody. Trial, found not guilty. Narcotics cases. The following defendants were convicted in U.S. District Court or Los Angeles County Superior Court of various narcotics-related charges and were sentenced to federal or state prison. 1. Franchina, Richard, Richie. 2. Martinez, Rudy, Rocky. 3. Nelson, Donald, Hobbit. 4. Ramirez, Giovanni, Gio. 5. Panachia, Michael, Casper. 6. Garcia, Robert, Bobby Loco. Interstate thefts of stolen motorcycles. The following two defendants were convicted in U.S. District Court for removing vehicle identification numbers, VINs, on motorcycles and submitting fraudulent motorcycle registration documents and sentenced to federal prison. 1. Merdichian, Gerard, Buddy. 2. Merdichian, Joanne. Stolen property cases. The following two defendants were convicted in Los Angeles County Superior Court of possessing known stolen property and sentenced to state prison. 1. Martinez, Vicky. 2. Pam, last name unknown. Assault cases. The following defendant was found guilty in state court, County of San Diego, for assault with a deadly weapon and was sentenced to state prison. Slayton, Richard. Stolen motorcycles. The following defendants were convicted in Los Angeles County Superior Court of motorcycle thefts. 1. Gomez, Felipe. 2. Martinez, Francisco. 3. Pisano, Jose. Rico. Rico charges against the Mongols Motorcycle Club and its members are still pending. Case Agent, Special Agent John Chacon, L.A. Group 2. Undercover Agent, Special Agent William Queen, L.A. Group 2. This is Don Leslie. We hope you've enjoyed this production of Under and Alone. The true story of the undercover agent who infiltrated America's most violent outlaw motorcycle gang, by William Queen. Published by arrangement with Random House Audio Publishing Group, a division of Random House, Inc. Text copyright 2005 by William Queen. Production copyright 2006, Books on Tape.